VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Today, we look back at some of the top science and technology news stories of 2016. I'm joined today by several of my colleagues who are science, health, and technology journalists here at the Voice of America. With us today from the VOA News Center, in no particular order, are George Butich, Kevin Enix, Steve Barragona, and joining us today is Anne Ball, a science journalist from VOA's Learning English. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Great to be here.
This is an odd gathering, a rare gathering. Anyway, you've all been covering science-oriented news for years now, and looking back over the past year, would you say that there were more notable advancements in science in 2016 than in previous year? Let's start with George Butich.
Thank you. Last year was very, very exciting when you look at especially technology advances. Self-driving cars, 3D printers, robots, Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, all have made great strides during the past year. And for the next year, we can say we can expect even more exciting news.
We'll get into the details of each of those points that you brought up. Kevin, looking back at 2016, more news, more science news, more science advancements than past?
I think, yeah. And I think that just like kind of advances in computational technology, which is kind of exponential, and since most of the technology is computer-based, you're seeing this kind of exponential jump in science stories as well, as our ability to do things, to get smaller, to get larger, and to get better at processing information. We're seeing more and more kind of discoveries just popping up.
Anne?
Space is near and dear to my heart, and I think that we've found some incredible information come out this year in the realm of space exploration. And we know more now about, from the New Horizons, about Pluto and Mars. There's a lot more information coming out about Mars. Space.
Steve.
Well, I was stuck doing election reporting for a good portion of the year, but I managed to keep an eye on climate change while I was doing that. And, you know, there's always plenty of news on climate change, and generally it's not good.
Okay, so, well, we got a lot to talk about today. So let's start from George's first topic, and that is self-driving cars. Now, when I think of self-driving cars, I think of a passenger sitting in the passenger seat and some robot sitting in the driver's seat driving. Would you feel comfortable riding in a self-driving car?
I think I would, judging by the things that I learned throughout the year talking with scientists who are researching self-driving cars. Artificial intelligence is getting better and better. We have better processors and better software that can process all kinds of things that the self-driving cars are filled with sensors, looking outward and inward. And the biggest problem was, and still is to some extent, processing all that information. But the computers are getting better, the software is getting better, and we now already have actually self-driving cars on the roads. Yes, we still do have humans behind the steering wheel that can take over at any moment, but most of the time those people are just sitting and looking around and taking notes of the things that need to be improved.
What would be the advantage of having a self-driving car?
A self-driving car eventually will be much safer than the human, because humans, as we all know, we make mistakes. Every single day, people around the world are dying in crashes that were caused by human error. Self-driving cars, or rather artificial intelligence in self-driving cars, will be able to react more quickly and to predict things more quickly. So they will be eventually inherently safer than the human drivers.
Let's go to Kevin. And of course, the big news over the last, I'd say at least the last decade, is the discovery of planets outside of our own solar system.
That's correct.
Extra solar planets.
Yeah.
And thankfully, through the efforts of NASA's Kepler mission, we've been able to discover hundreds of planets circling stars outside the solar system. But one in particular, this past year, one discovery was remarkable because of its closeness to Earth, Proxima B.
Yeah. Listen, oh, Proxima B was discovered earlier this year. It's about 4.2 light years away, which means, I mean, ultimately, if you can accelerate any kind of spacecraft to 10% the speed of light, which we can't do, but is conceivable, we could visit another planet in 40 years or so. So in the next couple of generations, if we were to launch it today, which also won't happen, but it's nice to think about.
Right.
And so the thing that makes Proxima B important is not just Proxima B, because chances are it's not habitable because it's so close to its star, it's being bombarded with kind of electromagnetic radiation from its sun.
And its sun is a
red dwarf?
It's a red dwarf called Proxima Centauri, and it's very close to that star as well because it's much cooler than our sun.
But isn't it in the habitable zone?
It is. It is in the habitable zone, which means what that means is that it's in a temperature range where liquid water can exist. And water means life. NASA has always said so. But I think the most fascinating thing about Proxima B, which is what the NASA scientists said, was that its discovery puts the number of Eta-Earths, which is a phrase that means
that
Earth-like
before.
Planets,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
And if I can back up a little bit, there's something you may be aware of called the Drake equation, which is the number of stars in the galaxy, the number of those stars that have planets, the number of those planets that are habitable, the number of those planets where life has evolved, the number of, and it goes on and on to try to make a stab at figuring out how many potentially intelligent life forms have evolved in the universe. But what NASA scientists tell me is that the discovery of Proxima B means that the number of Earths that might live in a Goldilocks zone, that number might be one, which means over time we can expect to find a planet in the Goldilocks zone around every star in our galaxy. And that's an amazing number, which means life outside of our solar system is almost inevitable because you've got a little planet where liquid water will exist, a sun around every sun in the galaxy. And that's kind of a big deal, and that's part of what the discovery of Proxima B excited people about.
My question to follow up with that would be to Anne, and we're talking about the possibility of life, at least one planet around every star in the known universe at least. But the thing is, once you discover life, or once you discover the possibility, how are you going to investigate whether or not there is life and there is a project?
Yes, there is a project. This is done by Yuri Milner and Stephen Hawking, and it's called Breakthrough Space Starshot. Breakthrough Starshot. And they are going to send, now this is pie in the sky right now. Kevin was talking about how long it will take till we can get some spacecraft to Proxima B. But what these people have come up with, and they've got funding by Mark Zuckerberg, I mean, and Yuri Milner. So these are some heavyweight people. They're still trying to figure out how it's going to work. But they have these little star chips, and it's a gram scale wafer. It's this little wafer, and they're going to put thousands of them in a mothership, and they're going to send it up into space, and then they're going to release these chips, and they're going to have these sails on them, and they are going to be fueled by lasers from Earth. It does sound like science fiction.
It does.
But they're going to have cameras and photon thrusters and power supply and navigation and communication equipment. And they're saying it will take 20 years to get these little star chips to Proxima B. They're going to take a picture. They're going to take pictures. And then they're going to send the pictures. They say, you know, it'll take some years for the picture to get back to Earth. So theoretically, it's possible that in our lifetime, we might actually see a picture of Proxima B, but it hasn't been developed.
Is the technology existing to be able to do that? I mean, right now we have Voyager that was launched back in the 1970s. That's in interstellar space right now, but, you know, all we're getting back are some telemetry signals. How are we going to get a picture back?
Well, remember, the Webb telescope's going to go up.
That's right.
Reasonably soon. And that's going to give us, yeah, it's going to give us a much better eye. And that will allow us to do some spectrographic analysis of some of these things we've been wanting to look at. And you can find, arguably, do the math, some proof of life through the spectroscopic analysis of some of these extrasolar planets, now that we can get an eye on them. Suns are too bright for us to look at them very clearly right now, but we're going to get better at that.
And the radio telescope down in Australia, they have just, in the last month, I think, again, this breakthrough Starshot has taken over the radio telescope and is pointing it directly at Proxima B. So they have a direct line, but there's no guarantee that they're going to see anything, obviously.
What's interesting in the scientific community is one scientist proposes something or wants to do something, and it's up to other scientists to kind of shoot it down. And already I've read about that project where some scientists are saying this is going to be impossible, that these little devices, these little chips with sails on them, won't even make it past interstellar space.
Right.
Next big thing, of course, it's been something that we have been discussing for years now, and that is climate change. Steve, any insight into what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, 2016 is, we are well on track to be the hottest year on record. We had some pretty remarkable days this past summer. We had temperatures in the 50s Celsius in places like India and the Middle East. I mean, I saw a video of this poor little lizard that was like scampering across the sand, trying to get to the shade of this guy's truck out in, I believe this was out, it was someplace out in the Arabian Peninsula. It was something to see. And then you hear about people's flip-flops in India are sticking to the asphalt as it's the asphalt is melting. We've got the lowest ever Arctic sea ice extent, and the evidence just keeps mounting and mounting, and it's getting warmer and warmer in here. We did have some interesting kind of political developments in the Paris Climate Accord, but did come into force, which, you know, at least suggests that people think that this is a serious problem. We also had an agreement to phase out the air conditioner chemicals that are like massive greenhouse gases. So that was really good news. You know, so there's some optimism. I mean, one of the reasons why the Paris came into force so quickly was because, you know, there's a lot of people watching what a Trump administration might do about climate change. And so the rest of the world said, well, we don't want to deal with that. So that was one reason why it got brought into force so quickly. There's a lot of folks concerned that there are a lot of people who are skeptical, to say the least, about the science of climate change in his cabinet. And there's a lot of oil and gas people who are taking prominent positions in the cabinet. But one of the things that I've been following that I'm fairly optimistic about is the pace of change that's happening anyway in our energy system. There's a lot of change happening in the U.S., for example. There are coal plants that are shutting down left, right, and center, and that's the dirtiest.
And this is mostly due to economics.
It's mostly economics.
Yeah, because natural gas is cheaper.
Natural gas is cheaper. And some of these plants, you know, the utilities will say a lot of the reason that they shut down was because of mercury regulations. And, you know, nobody wants mercury. It's some nasty stuff. But once these plants are closed, they're not coming back. For the reasons that you mentioned, I mean, natural gas is just cheaper at this point, and nobody is building a new coal-fired power plant at this point.
And if I can toss in, speaking of mercury, there was some research that just came out last week that since the new mercury regulations have gone in, scientists who have been studying Atlantic tuna have noticed a 20-degree drop in mercury levels in tuna since those regulations have gone into effect. Yeah. So if you want to look at the practical effects of these kinds of regulations, you can see them. And you shouldn't necessarily right now eat much tuna for that reason exactly. So this is some good news as well.
Yeah. And if I may add, sources that generate power without carbon emissions accounted for 2/3 of new capacity added in 2016.
Now, when you're talking about alternate forms of energy production, we're talking mostly wind and solar?
We are talking mostly wind and solar and some wave energy, too.
And these are finally able to compete with fossil energy now. Like, you're getting to the point in many places without government subsidies. Wind and solar are competitive. I heard about a project in Dubai, a nation that produces natural gas, The winning bid on a new power project was a solar plant. Got the lowest price per kilowatt hour in a country that produces natural gas as a solar plant.
Yeah, that's because the technology is getting better, mm-hmm. and the solar cells are more efficient. Than
and they're
they
they're coming
before.
Up with more ways to make them more efficient.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
And so they lower the cost. It lowers the cost of making it, and the jobs are there's more jobs now in the alternative fuel, which is really great for mm-hmm. the country.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I see happening, is, especially in places like the West where they've got a lot of sun, mm-hmm. I don't know why they don't do this every place, put them over parking lots, you know, so you don't come out in the summer and, you know, your car is scorching hot and you can't touch your steering wheel because it's just too hot. You're starting to see this, you know, like I said, out in the West. I mean, there are places where it makes a lot more sense than others. Some of what's driving the adoption is state policy. Mm-hmm. You know, some places really encourage adoption, and some are like, "Nah, you can do it if you want."
I understand with the concern about the incoming Donald Trump administration that a lot of governors, local leaders are pledging to take control of things for
corporations. I mean, right. I'm General Motors, you know, a good old-fashioned car company, mm-hmm. has a massive solar array on one of their plants. The plant where they manufacture the Chevy Bolt, which is the first domestically manufactured electric car. Mm-hmm. Not the Volt. The Volt is like it's an electric car with a generator in it. The Bolt mm-hmm. is the full electric, mm-hmm. Plug-in electric. That plant gets half of its electricity from landfill gas. There's a lot of a growing number of major, you know, Fortune 500 corporations who have pledged to get all of their electricity from renewable sources.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Today, we're looking back at some of the more notable science, health, and technology news stories covered by VOA in 2016. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA, or you know what? Just send us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. We'll be back with more of our program after this.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
We're back with a science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today we're reviewing some of the top science, health, and technology news stories covered by the Voice of America in 2016. My guests are George Putich, Kevin Enix, Steve Barragona, and from the Learning English is Ann Ball. And we were talking about climate change, and the big key is technology. And what are some of the, going to George now, what are some of the other technological advances we're looking at as far as generating energy? Now, before we went to break, we were talking about getting energy from landfills. I mean, we're getting energy from places that people don't even think about.
Yes. Scientists are exploring all kinds of ways of harnessing energy from natural sources. But the problem is still, you know, it requires a relatively or absolutely speaking a rich nation to employ those new technologies. They are still relatively expensive for third world, mm-hmm. where you actually have more of the dirty sources, dirty industries that are polluting the air and water very much. So there's still a lot of work to develop sources that are cheap and that are affordable for other countries.
Yeah, you're starting to see growing concern about the amount of coal-fired power plants that are on the books in places like India and Vietnam and Indonesia. I mean, China...
China, the smog is...
Well, yeah, I mean, China's actually going in the right direction. China has their coal use, their energy production in general, their CO2 emissions have leveled off because they recognize that their air is toxic at this point. And people are mad about it. And, they, you know, it's a risk for civil unrest in China. And you see a really massive push into renewable energy from China. You're starting to see it in India as well, because their air is equally horrible. But they've also got big plans for coal-fired power plants. And, you know, this would, if India, if Vietnam, if China, or if Indonesia go ahead with these coal-fired power plants that they have on the books, it really doesn't much matter what the U.S. and China do with their emissions. They will blow us out of the water.
We were talking about different forms of energy. One form of energy we haven't mentioned even is a return to nuclear energy. We're seeing advancements in that? We're seeing a reintroduction of the technology?
Yes and no. The technology is out there. There are these modular, small modular reactors that are... one of the advantages is that you can build them in a factory instead of having to kind of custom build a massive, multi-billion dollar structure. These mm-hmm. are more, as the name suggests, they're small, they're modular. So you put a few of these things together. They're lower power, so you don't have to worry so much about, the amounts of heat, radiation, everything that you're producing. I mean, the problem in the U.S. is that nobody wants them. This has, been the problem since Three Mile Island, since Chernobyl, since Fukushima. There was talk before Fukushima about a nuclear revival. Not so much now. And in fact, the trend is the other direction. You've got a lot of these aging nuke plants around the country that are nearing the end or at the end of their useful lifespan. And some of them are, as we speak, they're up for renewal. And some of them are deciding, this is not worth it for us to... maintain these things to the level that's safe. And so they're shutting them down, which actually raises a lot of questions. Where are we going to get the electricity mm-hmm. to replace that capacity? And there's a risk that you wind up raising your CO2 emissions. Mm-hmm. You're seeing some plants being built in other countries, but there's one mm-hmm. new nuclear plant, on the books in the U.S., and that's about it.
One promising thing mm-hmm. is that the scientists are hard at work in developing a new type of nuclear energy source, which is fusion. It's very hard to achieve. The huge fusion plant that's being built in south of France is still some years off, but it's promising. And once we achieve this, and I'm sure that it is possible to achieve, we will have a cheap and abundant source of energy without the downside of mm-hmm. the today's nuclear plants, such as possible mm-hmm. radiation yeah. and especially storing of the spent fuel.
Yeah. It's dirty, and also it's expensive. As long as gas and oil are so low, nuclear mm-hmm. power is difficult to compete, especially right. if you're trying to build new reactors. It just doesn't make economic sense
right now.
Again,
it comes
down
to economics. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Now, I want to go back into outer space, and one of the big, big stories... that I remember is the discovery of Planet Nine.
Oh, yes.
We love Planet Nine.
Mystery Planet Nine.
Formerly Planet Ten.
Is there a Planet Nine?
Well, yes. According to Batygin and Brown at Caltech,
there is.
Yes, but we haven't seen it.
We will.
Eventually.
The math works, right? All the little trans-Neptunian objects, Mach Mach and Sedna and all these funny little planets out there, the way that they move... it's clear that something large, I think the math works out that Planet Nine is four times as large as Earth, but 10 times as massive. So when you take those gravitational effects and all the little things out there, it's fairly certain that it's there, but we won't know for sure until we see it. We'll see it soon.
Allegedly, it has a very weird and very large elliptical orbit.
Which is why we haven't seen it, because... that's so far out there.
It's probably somewhere out there.
I know the folks who are examining this or investigating this are booking a lot of time down in Chile at the Atacama telescopes, and of course the Suzuki telescope in Hawaii, of course, yeah. Mauna Kea. They're constantly searching for it. What I thought was interesting was a few months ago, one of the scientists speculated that once the Planet 9 starts making its return toward our solar system, as far as like the outer planets are concerned, it could cause some havoc, the gravity of such.
Perhaps, but listen, you have to be very careful. Like Planet 9 instantly fires up the aluminum helmet crowd, right? as being the famous kind of planet Nibiru that people have talked about,
right.
Which is this strange planet X that it comes close enough to Earth orbit in 10,000 years that it causes cataclysmic,
right,
and has destroyed civilizations and the dinosaurs and all that. And that's just simply not the case. It's a couple of hundred AUs its orbit, which puts it so far outside of the solar system as we know it. Mm-hmm. It won't have any particular impact on us, but it could throw off any number of rocks and send them kind of pushing into our orbit. But again, I mean,
there's also speculation from some scientists that Planet 9 is actually an exoplanet. You see that being a possibility?
So it's not ours, and we captured it?
That's a possibility.
So what did you talk to the scientists? What did they tell you?
Brown
and Batygin.
Sorry.
And they didn't talk about the exoplanet thing so much. It's something that happened to spot over the summer. But it's interesting that, you know, we're being invaded by an exoplanet.
Isn't that where the aliens from Buckaroo Banzai across the eighth dimension came
they
from?
They did.
Yeah.
It was
Planet 10 at the time when we
had Pluto as a planet. Yeah. Now it's a dwarf planet.
And speaking of aliens, the one thing I'm curious about, Anne, and you and I have talked about this a number of times, is Stephen Hawking's interest in this program.
Yes.
And earlier this year, he came out saying, maybe we don't want to contact aliens.
No, he has reversed himself on this, and I think it's fascinating. I would love to talk with him. If you're out there, Stephen Hawking, please call me, because I would love to talk to you about this, because originally he said, be very careful. We you might not want to invite aliens to our world, because you don't know what kind of powers they're going to have, if they're going to dominate us or we're going to dominate them.
Right.
And so, but now he's like all in on this breakthrough initiatives and going to Proxima B and the search for alien life.
What changed his mind?
I don't
aliens.
Know. I guess maybe it's that... I could speculate, but that would be pure speculation. I mean, I don't know, because I haven't interviewed him. Mm. But my guess would be that he wants to be part of the search. You know, we should have people who know what to look for and where be involved in it.
Go ahead. I was going to say David Brin, who's one of my favorite science fiction authors, has speculated on other planetary intelligences and their efforts to talk to us, and the amount of energy that is necessary to send out signals on a planetary scale is so profound that we might hear that it would suggest a group of beings that are autocratic and able to force an entire planet to focus like pyramid builders to create a source of energy powerful enough to beam a message to Earth, and we don't necessarily want to have anything to do with those people. And also just taking the fact that doing something like this suggests a type A personality that perhaps...
The mind boggles. The mind
yes,
boggles. Well, lady and gentlemen, we believe it or not, we're out of time. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us for today's program, George Putich, Kevin Enix, and Steve Barragona from VOA's News Center, and Ann Ball from VOA's Learning English. Thanks so much, guys. It's been fun.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Faith Lapidus and to our engineer for today, Joe Gill. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA
on The Voice of America.